Yeah, I think we already started. We already started. Yes. We're the beans, guys.
So, yeah, thanks, we're here now.
Thanks for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate that. No problem. I mean, you were on my podcast a couple of months ago, right? That was February.
I was. Yeah, it was a great, great experience. I loved it.
Yeah, that was a great podcast.
Yeah.
I learned so much.
Yeah, we had a really good discussion. And I figured I'd have you on my podcast because I feel you have a lot of knowledge that's outside of my very specific depth. You have a lot of breadth. And I'd like to experience that from somebody who understands the travel industry, understands mobility, understands basically everything, puts it all together clearly and concisely.
Torsten, I was really excited to hear from you just because of all the world traveling you've done and you're an expert in the travel industry, which is an industry that's changed so much over the last 2 years, especially. Even before that, it was changing.
Yeah.
But now, especially, it's just all new. The way I get around has changed.
Yeah. Yeah, it went through like a huge disruption. And, you know, I've been seeing travel as coming from the online landscape. So I started with a business that's actually in the automotive industry. We actually built a business to help suppliers, tier one suppliers in the automotive industry, to find other suppliers, tier two, and then tier two, we've tried to help them find tier three suppliers. And I came out of an industry that was really focused on that online part. I always felt like all the good things for me came out of the internet. And we built that company, and then we went to mostly suppliers in the automotive industry in Germany and tried to sell them something online. And they looked at us and like, what are you talking about? And they were like, so when do you ship us the software? And so what is this procurement software you're selling? And we were like, no, you don't. There's no shipping, right? You just use it online. And they're like, that's fine, but it's free, right? And you're like, no, it's $30,000 a month. And they were like, well, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
So this everything that we now see is completely a given, right? So we call it SaaS, or for a while we called it ASP. We started with this, and we were clearly 10 years too early. So it was difficult to build that company. And from then on, I always was curious about the travel industry. So I built a metasearch engine that we eventually sold. And I built a couple of different content ventures. And I always felt like the travel industry, like many other industries now, is being invaded by software, right? It's being eaten up by software, but it doesn't. And people expect it sooner or later to behave like software. Like it has these 10x jumps, you know, doubles every 18 months, what is it? I think 18 months storage, Moore's law, and also in computing power. But the travel industry somehow never wanted to innovate that quickly. Like it's always behind and always trying to struggle and saying, oh, we could still sell travel trips and catalogs, like package travel, right? Or the right to the airport should be more expensive than the flight, which was true for the longest time before Uber. So I think the travel industry really fought hard to not innovate too much. The airlines probably were better. They definitely got the marketing right and their loyalty programs. But I felt there was a lot of pushback from anyone who was active in the travel industry before. How does this whole innovation play out in the travel sector? So I'm still a more active participant, but I'm still mesmerized how this actually went down.
Now, when did this all start? When do you think this innovation between travel agents said, look, we're falling behind, we got to do something new, we got to bring something new to the game? Or was it like a Netflix blockbuster push? These other competitors came in and kind of disrupted the way, you know, Delta was doing stuff. You go on their website, buy tickets, or you go on United. When was that kind of tipping point?
I think it was Expedia, right? So Expedia came out and people realized, oh man, we can compare prices for tickets online. And before, you had to go to a travel agency, which is, you know, cumbersome, and you had no transparency. And that really launched that whole thing that people realized, oh, we can actually at least see the prices. And then relatively soon, you could buy it on OTAs, online travel agencies. You could buy tickets for American, but you would go to the American Airlines website and the same price wouldn't be there. For the longest time, you couldn't even buy it from the airline itself. The price was not the same, right? Because they had some really strange pricing. And all these distribution channels were like so carefully managed over such a long time. And then Expedia just disrupted all of this. And so everyone struggled to make sense of this new world. And I think the first who got it right were probably the companies like Ryanair, right? They shifted all the distribution online, no more travel agents, no, just basically metasearch. They would allow to an extent. And they built their brand. I think Southwest really also profited from this. They've been there before that, but really taking off in such the scale they've they achieved that wouldn't have been possible without the internet. So I think this came all from the distribution channels. And then later on, people expected every day that ticket prices behave like Moore's Law, right? Mm-hmm. You should eventually, we should see business class tickets for $200. And that's
keeping it inflated.
That's kind of what we're working on, right? So it's what we do with Mighty Travels Premium now is tell people when these things are that cheap, but it's relatively rare. And it's the problem is simply that the plane costs kind of the same, if not, it's more expensive. The oil costs mm-hmm. the same, you know, the fuel costs the same. There is this bit of savings in terms of fuel consumption, but the airline industry itself is, and the hotel industry is kind of the same, right? It's still the same real estate and the room mm-hmm. rates. Nothing has changed so much.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Interesting. So there must be a lot of different technologies that the travel industry is looking to adopt to make things better. A couple of technologies that we look at a lot in automotive and also being a manufacturing company. Well, for automotive, it's AI, of course, for perception and planning. On the smart factory side, we look at blockchain technology. That's sort of a hot topic lately. Is there any way these two technologies could transform the travel industry as well?
I think flying electric airplanes, that would do the trick. Mm-hmm. And we've seen at least the prototypes are actually doing this finally. So I think this the core industry of travel, the whole service business of travel, I think it's already, it's very competitive, it's very digital. But the whole, you know, we actually move people around and you burn oil. That's kind of like the car industry. Like everyone is still wishing nothing changes. I feel like the car industry was there for the longest time, and you guys probably are now. It's the spearhead of what's changing. And they would rather live in a world where change isn't happening, or it would be more cosmetic. I mean, I don't think the airlines certainly would love to see the price of planes be driven down, but there is currently no technology that does it, at least not for a 300-seater plane. So it is, I think there's a bit of a gloom in this that they can't really attach themselves to the same trajectory as what we see with Moore's Law and other industries. And I'm actually very bullish about other industries like healthcare, because we now have all these sensors, kind of where you guys also come in, right? That all these sensors that make us more trackable as humans with our sensor data, we can maybe change healthcare before we can change travel to that extent that we want to see, that it all behaves like Moore's Law, that we see this massive amount of innovation that gives enormous cost savings. Because right now, while the prices of tickets have gone down and we have more people in the same airplane, it's, I don't know what it is, it's maybe one third of what it was 50 years ago. So it's definitely deflationary, but it's not crazy deflationary like an iPhone.
Right.
So let me ask you a question here, because you work in a very, you know, when you think of travel, when I think of transportation, I think of very discrete. We go to point A to point B. When I think of mobility, I think of the seamless kind of not discrete way that we travel from our home to, let's say, Tokyo. Or if we got on the scooter to go to a taxi, to go from the taxi to a train, from a train to the plane. But you work in a very specific area, which is travel by plane. How would you define the world changing over the next 10 years, looking at these multimodal transportations that are taking place across the entire ecosystem?
Well, I've been very critical of Uber from a perspective that I love it as a consumer. I love that service, but I always felt the business model is just not there. The network effect is not there. What they basically did, they subsidized millions of people's rides, which is great. It's kind of like a public subsidy. It's kind of like Indonesia puts money into low fuel costs. But in the end, this is not very productive. So what we've been doing there is subsidizing rides that work exactly the same as before with a slightly better booking way. It's a little easier and a little more efficient. It's kind of like the whole travel industry, right? The front end is distribution channel, it has changed, but the back end is the same. People sit in cars. So it's very difficult for Uber to create a price level, I feel, that makes them long-term profitable, because there's no real network effect from my point of view. We can go into this. But I feel the travel industry needs something that works digitally. And I was very bullish on, for instance, the scooters. So I think there was a couple of VCs that put a few billion dollars into the Lime, for instance, the early scooter companies. Until I saw that the price per mile is extremely high. So they're even more expensive than Uber. It's not people, but it's these scooters and the maintenance of these scooters because they get trashed a lot. That's no fun. You don't want to be in that business, I felt, to make transportation cheaper. And I've also been very critical of cars, electric cars. And I think we talked about that in the podcast. I'm really disappointed that we look at electric cars as these high-end luxurious cars, which I think the opposite should be true. If we have an innovation, yes, for a while, but a short while, it should be luxurious and out of reach for the consumer. But generally, I attribute innovation for the consumer, especially, to something that's is as good, maybe slightly better, but it's like dramatically cheaper. And that's where I think the electric car in China comes from, right? So it's not as good. It's kind of like the first digital camera is not great, but it's super cheap and it grows exponentially over the next 5 years. And I feel we've lost that touch. And obviously the airline business is just starting because the airplanes are just becoming available, hopefully in the next 5 years, to create that deflationary process of the heavy technology progress and then also adoption. And I kind of trace this back, and you know, it's Peter Thiel saying that we wanted flying cars and we got 140 characters. And I think what he's just quipping about, and obviously there's been white papers before that about the low productivity growth, is that we don't dare enough. And I think the auto industry has the same problem, right? The auto industry was one of the most conservative ever. Maybe it's changing now, and I'm curious what you guys maybe tell me. But it hasn't dared. We could have built an electric car before, right? It was always possible, but then all the whole supply chain would have been left out. So everyone tried to push it up. All of Germany knew it was possible, but they tried to push it off to the last possible moment, but it really had to do it. And now, of course, it's changed. But I don't see a lot of cheap electric cars. I want a $5,000 electric car. Where is my $5,000 electric car? I can't believe it's not there.
Yeah, really interesting point. We've seen some cost-driven innovation in the airline industry, right? Southwest is really one that comes to mind, where they had a whole new business model to offer very low-cost tickets. And to a lot of passengers, right, it didn't really matter to them which airline they flew as long as they got to where they were going. So it was really, travel was commoditized for these people, and Southwest really realized that and took advantage of that. I guess I would like to know what sorts of things are these airlines working on now that can really attack that desire for lower cost. I think a lot of travelers just don't care about anything else. It doesn't have to be nice, fast, whatever. Just get me the best price. Maybe EVs don't quite have that in the market yet.
Yeah. So what I think there's this one sector of the airline industry that's done very well. There's a discount airlines like Southwest, but especially Allegiant, especially Spirit and Frontier. They barely had been hit by the pandemic. I feel they've been back to their route network, even exceeding it within 6 months after the pandemic. So they were the first to recover. And then the problem, obviously, is what's going on with this whole business travel, right? So we had all these fancy airline seats and really great service, but it was priced far outside of a leisure market. And a few airlines, like especially Qatar, they've already adopted, but prior to the pandemic, more of a leisure market model for certain routes. So, for instance, they would shuttle most of Europe to Africa on a very competitive $1,500 round trip business class ticket. And it's pretty long flights, up to 12 hours. And that's kind of a market they wanted to break in because they realized, man, it's just no business demand, or at least not at the prices they want to sell at, right? Maybe $3,000 for that round trip. So I think we're going to see a relatively new model to fill those business class seats, because you need a different pricing power. It's not just upgrade. It's really something that needs to be priced competitively. So they definitely will drop. But of course, it uses way more space than economy seat. So it's, in the end, how many bodies can you pack in? And one thing I feel that I've been working on that quite some time ago, and there's more designs now, there is ways how you can A, get more people into the same aircraft, but also B, get them in a more comfortable position. And what I'm talking about is kind of a lie flat seat for everyone, like irrespective of where you fly. And you would get, because you use it in a different way, you get 50 up to 80% more people into the same airframe. And a lot of people are working on these designs. The question is, will the airlines have enough incentive to adopt them, right? And right now, the airline industry is too many planes, but no passengers. Mm. But if we ever get to this utilization again, I think if some of them will really adopt these prototypes, like Air New Zealand has been working on this. So you have an economy section, and then downstairs, maybe you have a sleeping section, kind of what you have in certain trains. That's a good idea, but it's never really, there isn't a ton of interest from the airlines. And they're the most risk-averse people I've ever talked to. Like, if you have a new design or mm-hmm. want to do anything different, it's even worse than the automotive industry. They're really, really conservative, let's put it this way. And they try to defend their business as is.
I see. When I was a poor college student, I always wished for a standing room in planes. I didn't even need a seat. I'll stand. I just need
Ryanair, right?
Stand like on the subway and give me a cheap price. I guess that's not going to happen.
Makes sense.
Oh, Ryanair wants to do it, but it's not allowed, right? The FAA is terrible. It's even worse than the FDA.
Right.
So if you want to introduce anything new, the egress and ingress, especially the egress in terms of emergency, it's such a nightmare. And then it needs to be wide enough. Obviously, that's a good idea for the ADA requirement. It's really, really difficult to get anything, any change approved. And that's the trouble with all this regulation.
Yeah.
And to escape it, we need a new sector, right? Maybe we classify kind of what the drones did. They did it for drones, right? They said these tiny little drones, they are not really unmanned aircraft. They are just unregulated. That's why they took off. And maybe we need the same thing for the travel industry. And I think it's also curious. I'm curious what's going to happen to the whole hotel industry that was really in this forever slightly increasing hotel rate, the average daily hotel rate, the ADR. And it always kept growing forever. And they built like commercial real estate and often was now part of bigger development. And they never anticipated that rates could drop by 50% long-term. This is exactly what happened, right? New York City, San Francisco, yeah. LA, all the rates have dropped tremendously. And before it was one of the most expensive places on the planet. Now it's for the quality you can get, like a 5-star high-end hotel, it's really cheap. And I don't know if hotels with their 30-year business plans, right? If they can really long-term react to this, I don't know if there's enough margin. They cut down a lot of services, so they are cheaper and they let staff go. But that cuts you maybe 20% and you're still down 50, 60% in your room rate. So we haven't seen a lot of price adjustments on the, you know, below $100 a night rate. But I think above that, prices have changed dramatically. So lots of places that used to be $700, $800 every night in San Francisco are now $200, $150. Wow. Mm-hmm. So it's a massive change. So that's cool for travelers. If you have that kind of budget, it's a really good deal. But obviously the business travelers are missing, right? There's nobody there traveling on business because nobody pays $800 a night.
Right. Let me throw you a curveball here because just a little bit talk about mobility, specifically related to cars. So as an outsider, I'd like to get your perspective on what do you think about headlights, first of all? It's not really a thought of, yeah, I need them. Are they cool looking? Are they getting better? Second, what do you think about companies trying to put sensors, more sensors in the headlights? And finally, what is your opinion of moving into the autonomous driving realm? Do you think it's something we'll really accomplish over the next decade, or you think it's a few decades out?
All I know about headlights is what I learned from you, Amit, in our last podcast. And obviously, I know that they've gotten so much better in the sense of how much light they emit, right? I find that really annoying as a person being not in the driver's seat, but going on a run. That's the only thing I notice, how much brighter car lights I've gotten. And you see the huge difference of a recent car and a 5-year, 10-year-old car, right? Yeah. So that's kind of annoying. It's great for when you're in the driver's seat, then I love it. I think, and I'm curious how you guys see your own position there. We have this massive industry in one. I think software is going to eat you guys completely. Once you have all these sensors everywhere, you know, the prices for sensors, they're dropping so quickly. The iPhone GPS sensor used to be like $30. Now it's maybe 30 cents, but within less than 10 years.
Right.
And the question is, how do you carve out a unique part of that supply chain if everything looks the same? And we saw this kind of, there was the race between Apple and the generic desktop computer. For a while, we had all these generic desktop computers and nobody really could make money from it. Some people did, but Dell has been doing really badly with that business model because you couldn't really define your own competitive advantage. And I think the same is going to happen to cars now, is that we can, there's certain standards are required to become interchangeable. And obviously you're not a car manufacturer, you're just focusing on lights. But I think the risk is that it becomes so interchangeable that you can just throw together sensors from wherever you get them the cheapest. You get all these components pre-packaged, you just put your label on. It's kind of what BMW already did. But not so many people could build their own car. Let's put it this way, the competition was somewhat limited. But once with electric cars, it gets so much simpler to literally make your own car and then also use it for autonomous driving, that makes it even more commoditized. I don't know what your guys' strategy is, how you're going to stay ahead of that competition, because you kind of become either a chip manufacturer, like you have your own plant, or you become what a lot of Apple suppliers are. They basically just, they're a non-fab chip supplier. I think this is where I see you guys, right? So you create this component, but you don't actually put the work in. Someone else is going to manufacture it, but you just do the innovation. Mm-hmm. I think if you adopt this innovative mindset right now, and I don't, this is what I think of you guys. I don't have no idea how the competitive industry works. I think this will be the winner of the next cycle. Whoever is able to kind of get rid of this whole, we make real things, and just focuses on this non-fab part, right, on the creating the software. And it's tough. I mean, it's probably going to change your business model. How many people actually work on making stuff in your company?
Yeah, about 80% are North American. So we have 6,000 people in North America. I would say about 80-85% are making stuff, putting this stuff together, the people on the production line. I think you nailed it. According to Dan and I think you nailed it. That's exactly what we're looking at, is how do we move to our adjacent transformational technologies by putting software into our lights. Yeah. I'm curious to get your opinion on, okay, so let's put software into our lights, but over the next 10 years, is autonomous driving something you really want? Is that attractive to you?
Oh, yes, 100%, because it's cheap. So I think people forget about what innovation brings with it. It's because it's cheap. It's good, or as good as before, maybe better, but it's super cheap. And I think a big problem that we have is, so we have this big amount of inflation that we all feel is coming. But what we've seen is actually deflation in lots of sectors, and the total inflation was kind of mediated, let's put it this way, over the last 20, 30 years. And why did that be mediated? Because we basically could import a lot of stuff that we need from China, and that's hugely deflationary, or it was technology. If it's fully automated, it would be extremely cheap, because we basically get rid of all the drivers, right? So once we build it once, and then we just roll it out, and we can import a huge amount of deflation. And if I can, instead of paying $100 for an Uber ride, if I can be an automated car and it's $10, I mean, the market is endless, right? So this is like free energy. If you can produce something that, you know, obviously building it is going to cost a lot of money, but once it's built, you can roll it out almost unlimitedly. This is changing everything. Like, if we had free energy, we can go to the stars tomorrow. We don't have to wait for anything, but we have to dig out the oil and everything, super inefficient. So I think the market is massive for this, and it might be different than what we think. It will not one-to-one replace what we do now. So my, if I had a morning commute, I would still want to drive, maybe, but maybe not. And maybe I would, if I'm in Germany on an Autobahn, yeah, of course I don't want a self-driving vehicle. I want my own fast vehicle, right? So it will replace certain things, but it could also create new markets. And if you are in the hardware business, you got to speak Chinese and live in China and be in China. Otherwise, get the hell out, right? Get the hell out and go into software. And I learned this from Brian. He was on an episode. He started a hardware business, I thought, right? It's a digital picture frame. They've been really popular a couple of years ago, and he kind of redesigned everything. He's like, dude, should I really do this? And I'm like, no, hardware businesses are terrible. Don't do it. He's like, yeah, but you know what? This iPad-like device that they produce, it's only $10 or $20. But it's like a whole iPad, right? It does the same thing with a display. And he said, yeah, well, it's a software company, because all the value that we generate is already software. Mm-hmm. So this is where we have very rapid innovation. We can go through the cycles. We talk to customers. We get out there. They tell us what they want. We come up with the next design, maybe a little cheaper, maybe a little better. And that's how we win, because we are faster. And if you can do this for all the industries out there, I think this, we all have a much better life.
Yeah, really interesting. Well, it sounds like the mobility industry, automotive industry that we work in, and the travel industry are really intertwined, and innovation on one side impacts innovation on the other. And I think autonomous vehicles are going to have an impact on travel as well. I mean, the first chain hotels arose because the automobile allowed people and families to travel at longer distances. We were no longer talking about day trips, right? People needed a place to stay in an unfamiliar place. So these chain hotels were offered a familiar hotel, like the McDonald's of hotel that you knew and trusted the brand. So I think autonomous vehicles will kind of have a similar impact. How do you see autonomous vehicles and their proliferation changing the travel industry and some of the services that are available for people?
Well, one thing that really makes me very optimistic about the travel industry is that it's one of those, it's bound to our natural instinct of exploring, right? So when you go out and ask people, would you like to travel? Forget about COVID for a moment, forget about your budget. Before it was mostly how much money can you put in. Now it's really about, well, where do you feel safe about COVID? But let's forget about these things. Would you like to travel more or less in your life? It's very rare you find someone who isn't jaded by travel. If you have to go to the same destination, especially, you get jaded quickly. Mm-hmm. But if you go to slightly new places or with a slight, it can be the same country, but a slight different tune to it, rarely anyone will ever say, oh, I travel too much. Most people would say, no, I travel everywhere, every single place on the planet. And there's been a few years ago, maybe 20 years ago, it was really rare to find someone who has been to all countries in the world. And now I had like half a dozen people on the podcast who've been to 193 countries in like Charles Valley. He's been to 900 different regions. So you can subdivide this into regions, you know, like every state in the US is a region, or mm-hmm. every oblast in Russia and every province in China. So you not everyone is as determined, but when we were chatting, everyone was like, well, from whatever we see, there's going to be thousands, if not tens of thousands of people who went to 193 countries, an unimaginable feat 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. Only mm-hmm. the billionaires could do it. And you know, even they had trouble. So there is this huge demand out there. And I think whatever you can use to make that, it's a core human experience to see the rest of humanity lives, because there's so much out there that we can learn that makes us happier, that makes us better, that makes us more productive. It gives us a new way of thinking that you can potentially learn at home, but it's so much harder. VR immersion compared to a dial-up connection, right? If you're actually there, it's so much easier.
Right.
And if you put in autonomous vehicles, obviously it's in the car, it's not just you drive somewhere, it's that you're sheltered. You see this in Malaysia a lot. I always love that people, most of the time in Malaysia, they don't really want to drive anywhere. They just want to cool down. So they use it as their particular AC, as their mobile AC.
Wow. Okay.
So you just go through the town, hang out in front of a coffee shop, and literally sit in their cars, yell at their friends. The friends come over for a second, and then they go back to their car, and then maybe they talk on the phone. So it's just so hot, like, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's like 140 or something, yeah. the heat index. And so there's many, many other uses, and we will find more users if it gets cheap enough. I don't actually know enough of them. There's a lot of places that are basically undiscovered right now because there's no roads, for instance, or it's expensive to get there, or there's entry restrictions, but it's far out of the beaten map, of the beaten path. And those are the best places. Like whenever mm-hmm. you talk to travelers, been to a lot of places, they try to avoid tourists. And then they go a step further and say, oh no, we want to avoid places with lots of people. And then they go further. And I think it was Jim McNeil. And he said, yeah, if I see five people somewhere where it's cool, I avoid them. I go the other way. Like he usually goes to the North Pole by himself. And he's like, that's fine. You know, well, why are you worried about me? So if we have an option to get us in safe shelter anywhere we want, and even the more remote places, this is going to open up huge new markets. And we could have done this now, but it's still tricky. Like I had this trip to Africa coming up and I wanted to go, and it never happened. And I really want to go from Ethiopia, from Addis, all the way down to South Africa. But it's tricky how to set up this trip, right? You can't rent a car one way. Some countries you drive on the left, some you drive on the right. You go through Kenya mm-hmm. and South Africa. There's you can buy a car, but then you have to worry about selling it, and then you have to get a permit to get to the next country. So it's a lot of hassle. And there's roads, fortunately, but you know they're not all great. So you need like an SUV or you need a pickup truck. I find this a big challenge. If there would be an, you know, like the Waymo car I have in mind, you know, that that looks like a $2,000 car. Maybe it's even cheaper. It looks really crappy, but it's, I think they're going the wrong way. If you would have billions of this in Africa and just shuttle wherever you want, if this was like a cell phone, which works everywhere, I think the market is incredibly, it's incredibly big for this. Now people underestimate that. If you can build a $2,000 mobility device that somehow works like the Indian Tata, right? Was it?
Tata.
The Nano. Yeah. That's changed the game in India.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
Wow, that's some good knowledge. We really appreciate that because there's a lot of new things to think about. We're only thinking about North American markets mostly, or I would say developed countries, but you gave us some ideas on how to expand in underdeveloped or developing countries. My friend told me that when he went to India, it was really hot and he got in the car and you pay a certain price for getting from point A to point B. But then the business model is if you want the AC on, you pay an extra 100 rupees. So it's so hot, you'll pay anything. So basically, they got you trapped.
That's when you're not used to it. Yeah. I lived in Delhi. Absolutely. Okay. It's because I mean the consumption goes up. It's the fuel. It's literally more expensive, and also the cars that have AC. You know, most cars don't, or they don't. You never use it, so they're charged as a premium. So it's a thing, and Malaysia has that too. I think what's core to all this is finding a market that loves you, and I think as an entrepreneur, that's one of my biggest learnings. That maybe I wasn't really conscious about is, you know, but as every startup, every company has that same problem. You don't want to be somewhere where you are just tolerated. Like many businesses you go, you're tolerated. You want to find that spot, even if it's out of reach, even if it's in India, but India is not that far of reach. Or say it's in Angola. You want to find that spot, you as an entrepreneur, you as a person too, and to some extent, but you as a business are really appreciated. And people come running towards you instead of just, okay, there's yet another guy who's selling us the same stuff and we are not interested in it. And that makes a big difference. So either you're not properly positioned or your marketing is crap. And I talked to these guys who did this baby warmer. So it's actually a device that helps premature babies to keep warm because that's all they apparently need. They don't need oxygen on the crap. They just need warmth and then they're fine, but like 24/7. And they need to be stabilized. You know, you can't just put them on your belly. So it literally it's like a warming battery. And these incubators cost $20,000. And then they're plentiful in our hospitals because there's only so few premature babies. But in India, there's nothing, right? So they actually went to India and sold a $500 device to the Indian government. Think about this. Silicon Valley company, the only customer isn't India, it's the Indian government. What a mess. But they made it work. And, you know, they built a company on top of this. That's where you need to be. I mean, I think they went all the way to the extremes. They have dealt with Indian massive government corruption, bureaucracy, and they made it happen. So if you can find, can position your company in one of those new markets, you have a shot. But if you're just there and you're like already pitching against, that's why I think Tesla is misplaced. They're pitching against BMW and Volvo and Audi, and there's 1,000 brands, different brands. And yes, it's nice to drive an electric car, but look, if it's also a lot of hassle. Like if you're that rich, you don't have a lot of time. Why do the hassle with a Tesla? I never understood this. But if they would have gone to a market with nobody, but that would be the only option. Tesla is doing well, so I'm not hating on Tesla. I know you're a big fan.
No, that's a very interesting comment because I heard a podcast or something recently about Impossible Burger, for example. And the goal wasn't to attract more people to be vegetarian. The goal was to give protein to people who can't get protein. So they're selling it for a certain price in the United States, but they're selling it for a lot cheaper in Africa and India, for example, because those people aren't getting enough of their daily protein per day. So you're right. You make new markets and you can use the same kind of market, the same technology, but price it at a point that it's very desirable to move to that market.
How are you guys going to do this with lighting? What's the master plan for the company?
As you said, it's a hardware-based business, right? So we're trying to figure out ways, and Dan and I are pushing software. We're really pushing software. We're seeing how we can really change our current supply chain and to include more software, because you said it's the future. And if we have just basic lighting, let's just say a few LEDs and a reflector, and we can offer enough output that we can be changed by software depending on where we put this in certain areas in the world, then yeah, we can easily offer this. So we're definitely looking at new markets and new use cases.
Can you make it intelligent, like with a, with software update, like you can do it over the air?
Yeah, totally. We could do that. But the problem is we work with our OEMs. So we have to work closely with OEMs to figure out what do they need and what are their customers. Mm-hmm. But the market's getting so mixed up and melted. It used to be more of a, I describe it like Canada. Canada's a mixing pot, right? So people come to Canada, but they stay segregated. Like if you're Indian or you're French, you stay in your own little areas. Everybody that comes to America says, I'm American. And you're all mixed together. And that's what's happening to mobility right now. We're turning into a melting pot.
Yeah.
I think what is the hottest thing you think you can pack into in that area, right? We talked last time about all kinds of sensors, but what is like the hottest thing that people would want? And I know I'm talking about, like, the example is the iPhone and the Apple Watch. There's a lot of sensors, but for instance, there's no glucose and no blood pressure monitor because it's apparently very difficult. But that would be hot to put it in there. What's the equivalent in the car industry?
I think for coolness for us, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, for cool, people like stuff that's cool, that differentiates themselves from other people, right? That's why one person buys an S-Class over a Mazda 3. You just want to show that you have an S-Class. For us, it would be something that has projection lighting on it to tell you the time, it's snowing, all these kinds of things that tells the public around you, watch out, this S-Class is coming through when you're going in through a city area. So I think that'd be the coolest.
In the front lights,
right?
And
the S-Class also has the ability to add, instead of using the regular LED plastic lenses, you can switch to Swarovski crystals, for example. Mm-hmm. So those kind of things to show that you have this overwealth or this luxurious item.
That's cool. Yeah.
A lot of people will be attracted to that.
They love you in Dubai.
Yeah.
I was going to say, personalization is something that people are going to want. That's probably where it's going to go. An interesting thing has happened to headlights over the last 60 years. They used to be all the same. They were standard diameter. They are all round. Different car models use the same exact headlight, which is great because if it breaks, you're definitely guaranteed to have replacement parts. But it's boring, right? And now with LEDs, we've seen that a lot of branding and styling has happened with the headlight. Now, when you're driving around in your Mercedes S-Class, people know that you're awesome enough to afford a Mercedes S-Class. And that's the point of having that cool headlight. But the next is maybe you're driving around and it says, Torsten is here. And that headlight is only for you, or it's Amit's
birthday. I like that from Lyft.
My birthday today.
Yeah, when you get into a Lyft car, right? They have this LED in the middle and it says, hi, Torsten, and how's your evening? That seems pretty smart to me, but obviously that's a different use case.
And Dan and I took it one step further. We're talking about NFTs, for example. Let's say Torsten bought a car and had a specialized personalization that he created for himself that said, welcome, Torsten. Then Torsten had a kid who invented the next Google. Well, that basically is an NFT, right? That he created this personalization light. The value of that just went up 10, I don't even know how much, 200 fold, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the only one in the world.
Yeah. And
it's yours.
You're the dad of the guy who invented the next Google. So you think about it, like, wow, okay. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Anyways, we're going
to... I like that idea. Famous.
Sorry, yeah. I want to cut it down because we're kind of running out of time. A couple more questions. One is, we talked about what you do better than anybody else and you really enjoy, and you said your podcast. Could you describe how to make a successful podcast?
Yeah, well, that's still a work in progress, right? But I really felt when I started with the Judgment Call podcast that there's two things that were going on in my mind. One is that I'm an extremely curious person and I have only so many outlets myself. There's only so many people that in real life or in the online world really want to talk to me. And as an entrepreneur, you obviously got to be a bit of a generalist. Many of us are. So you're naturally driven to lots of different places that you find of interest, but you don't want to spend the rest of your life in. Right? When I'm really curious about an idea, maybe I'm going to spend 2 or 3 years with it, but mostly I'm just really interested in lots of different topics. I just had today, we talked really, really deeply about convexity and interest rate differentials, and carry trade. So that's really interesting to me, but I'm not a hedge fund guy. I would run my own hedge fund, but I would definitely get bored after a couple of years. Making money is great, but you want to do something else too. And I talked with Eric Wiener about Socrates and Epicurus and Nietzsche and Schopenhauer, his study on the old philosophers. So I find philosophy really interesting. And then there's this the same thing about anthropology. I had Joe Hendricks on this week, and we talked about how we can see if one culture has a slight competitive advantage to another, and how this works out long term about in terms of productivity. So these are all questions that kind of go into how the world works, and that was always something I was very interested in. And you know, this is something that I haven't grown beyond puberty. Maybe that's what it is. Jordan Peterson would say, "I'm not specialized enough. I haven't made enough right. sacrifice." but there's few of us who are just burdened with this being always a generalist. So I felt putting this into a podcast format would be a great fit. And I think it's a lot of fun for me to see this amazing insight that people have developed, and the way they see the world very differently through a very different prism. So it's great for me to experience this, but I think it's also great for an audience that gets a 1 hour, 2 hour introduction into a set of problems and ideas where it's very difficult to get that same kind of introduction without you knowing that you want it. So the problem is obviously you could find stuff on the internet, but you don't know what to search for. You don't know what to look for. And since we have all these echo chambers, and that was a 2020 theme that make us more narrow and narrow in our topics, I felt there should be something else. And that's where I wanted to be. And we are now in the top 50 in technology podcasts and worldwide. Amazing. And similar also for business. So it's something that I think has resonated with the audience. Obviously, there's a lot of competition out there. There's a lot of content out there, but I'm trying to make this A, entertaining, but also something that people learn and where they feel like, whoa, I didn't know that. That's kind of cool. I want to know more about it and maybe buy the book, or want to read what's actually going on in the field of longevity. I didn't know that. Lots of other people might have known this. But there is someone like Aubrey de Grey and David Sinclair, and they are extremely confident that we're going to be living forever in just 15 years from now, because we can actually heal aging. I didn't know that. I'm not saying it's probably because I'm ignorant, but the progress in lots of different industries is so much ahead of what is often currently accessible. I find this tremendously interesting. So I really love doing the podcast. I've only been doing it for the last 6 months, but they're tremendously enjoying.
If I can request the next guests, if you ever get a chance, for Naval Ravikant.
Yes, of course.
Robert Breedlove. I'd like to listen to those two guys.
Yes, I reached out to Naval. Hopefully it's going to happen. I don't know Mr. Breedlove.
If you get a chance.
Is it a given name or what's...
That's his name, Robert Breedlove. If you listen to his, it's like a 4-hour podcast with Lex Fridman about inflation, and he calls inflation basically legal counterfeiting, and goes through all the details over 4 hours.
I look him up. I like Lex podcast.
Great one for learning about Bitcoin and money, for those out there that want to learn more about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. That podcast really covers everything in depth. Well, great. That was really great advice, Torsten. Yeah. Thank you. And for me and Amit, you know, we've been doing this podcast for about 6 months now. And learning as we go, and learning from you. I appreciated our conversation a little bit earlier before we started recording as well.
Yeah, you guys are very talented. I think what I think is you have obviously the advantage that you have a marketing budget, and it's something that comes with the seriousness of North American lighting. Mm-hmm. But it might also hold you back. Right. It's something that you got to consider. It's something where you don't, if you make it, you make it, but it's not like your life depends on it. Not that my life depends on it, but it's like, I put my mind to it and I want to make it. Right. Let's put it this way. And so you guys, I think what the muscle you can use, obviously, is that marketing power. Right. And you said that last time, that by having the opportunity to appeal to an audience, even if it's a very niche audience, maybe in the beginning, it's just creates, and I think this is cool with the internet, just by listening to each other, we increase each other's potential. Like because we're more specialized, but we can specialize because you already told me like the sensor part that you told me last time, I could have found that somewhere else probably, but I wouldn't even have known how to get there, right? I didn't even know the keywords. So I know something now that you describe as very easy. So I can trust you that this is really an easy problem in that respect, right? So I don't have to worry about it ever again. And I think this is cool about the internet that we have these experts that pop up in all kinds of places where you never expect them. And then we just learn from it. Like you listen to it and then you know it, right? It's like we listen to Jordan Peterson and we all feel like we're psychologists, but we're not. We're idiots.
Right.
I mentioned we have a marketing budget, but also a great marketing person behind us.
Yeah. She's terrific.
She's really been supporting us very well.
How big is your team? Are you like, is it like the two of you and the marketing person?
That's it. Yeah.
That's it. Okay. Yep.
We just do this. She runs everything else. So we'll give her a shout out. Thank you, Kayla.
But when will I see the banner on the 101? When do I have to look?
The banner for?
Yeah, on the 101. You definitely want the banner at the airport. Yeah.
We'll put one soon, I'm sure.
Yeah. Okay, I like that. Yeah, we were chatting about how Genentech is putting ads for their own podcasts on all these buses in the Bay Area, which I think is a great idea because people listen to it when they commute. That's great. A good fit.
Well, Torsten, before we go, I'd like to ask you, a lot of our listeners are new grads and people who want to get into the automotive industry and the startup world in general. Your experience with entrepreneurship, I was wondering if you could give some advice for people who are looking to get into startups.
Well, that's a really broad question, right? But what a startup really... what it encompasses is slightly different for everyone. But if you want to get into the startup industry, I feel, and that's, I'm still amazed by this. I grew up in Germany, right? And the startup industry has all but vanished there. It still exists a little bit in Berlin, but it's gotten smaller in relative size to the population. It's still growing, right?
Hmm.
And but what I'm amazed by the US, and that's the first couple of times when I came here and pitched my own startup, I had a lot of people listening to it. I was like, oh, holy. And they gave me good feedback, right? So that doesn't mean they all wanted to invest or wanted to be a part of it, but they said, well, that sounds cool. If you need this or that, give me a call. And obviously a lot of people want to sell you stuff, but a lot of people were interested and eventually we got investors. What I always thought is if you can put together an idea and have the opportunity, obviously that depends on the industry. Software is really easy because you literally just have to code it yourself and play a little bit with GitHub, see what's out there. Build something that looks like a good prototype and have the guts and the positive, the euphoria that's probably needed, and go out there and talk to people and just talk to them for advice. Don't talk to them necessarily about money, but ask them, how could you make this work? How could you make this specific problem go away? So find a solution. And often VCs will tell you, well, first, what big problem are you solving? And I'm like, no, I just built this. I think it's really cool. I don't know what problem I'm solving, right? But this would be good if you know this answer. But most of us, we don't. As when I was younger, I had no idea how the world works. I still don't know, but I had even less of an idea when I was younger. So it's very difficult to have this master plan and say, how do I make the world a better place and solve this big global problem? If you can do it, fantastic, but very few, I think, can actually get to that level. But if you find something that's really cool, that's neat, that it's unique, that can be an app, that can be a bit of code, it could be a hardware solution, it could be both, maybe, and probably it's an amalgamate. If you put it together in a prototype and go out to the people, give them literally a message on LinkedIn, send them an email, say, this is what I have, just one paragraph, can I ask for your help? And I would be amazed if you don't get a ton of feedback. And sooner or later, you're going to be in the startup industry if you think this is for you.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much. That was terrific.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoy your trip.
It was my pleasure.
This was terrific.
Wonderful chatting.
Yeah.
I will see if travel is still real or it's just an online. Everyone's so scared. Like people think you can't go anywhere. But that's not true. But you got to be a little more strategic about it than it was a year ago or 2 years ago.
Right.
Great. When you get back, hopefully sometime we can connect in person. Dan and I can grab a beer with you in San Francisco.
Yeah, sounds like a good idea. I'll be back again probably August.
Great. Okay. Right. Enjoy your trip and thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Talk soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take it easy. Bye. Bye-bye.